I have a special guest with me, Barb Luukkonen. Now, Barb is a longtime listener and volunteer with the radio station, has lots of opinions, and so she shares those with me, and we are going to talk with Barb this morning about a variety of things. She retired but worked at the University of Minnesota's Water Resources Center. She's also been a teacher, a researcher for the EPA, and just generally very well-informed person. Seems to me, Barb, that your career theme is water and really educating people about everything associated with water. So anyway, thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning and to do some sharing.
Thanks for having me, Katya.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful.
Yes, I'm always one of those who listens to the story. It's a much more complex problem. So she hears from me a lot.
Yeah, and I think it's such a good question that you, I mean, it's, the issues you bring up are always good, but the larger question is also good, which is, you know, here we are in the modern world and people like sound bites. And I like to think that our 15 to 20 minute interviews are more than a sound bite, but they're cursory in many ways. And you are really good at reminding me, pointing out the sort of nuance or the context. It's almost always more complicated than it seems. So, you know, in some ways it's good just to talk about that in general. But I think we should start with some of the recent things that have come up on the radio so we can have a context for that discussion. We were talking about erosion last week and sort of the fact of erosion, and is erosion new? We all know that storms can be more intense now. And you have pointed out that erosion has always happened on Lake Superior. And in some ways, it has a lot more to do with people than the lake. So tell us, add some context to the erosion discussion of last week, if you will.
Sure. Well, you and Tara were talking about the erosion sedimentation into the lake from the SWCD. And, you know, we notice it, people notice it, or we notice that the rivers are running muddy. And I think, as I wrote you, well, 40 years ago, I was up doing some aerial photos and photographing all the mouths of the river carrying a lot of mud out into the lake. And actually, if I'd 400 years ago or 4,000 years ago, I would have seen the same thing. Because a lot of our shoreland is covered with the clay that was laid down in glacial Lake Duluth, which was around about 10,000 years ago and was 600 higher than lake is today, that clay erodes very easily since it's been running from the rivers and into the lake. Don't really like looks of that, you know, it looks dirty, but it's been happening for a long time. That's not to say that it's necessarily good, but that context has always been there. Now, people are causing these days more erosion and then sedimentation into the lake because we are building it close to the edge of the bluff. We're paving more, so causing more runoff. We're removing vegetation and making the banks more unstable. So we're increasing the erosion, and also our greater intensity of storms, at least in our lifetime of recording. There were probably some pretty significant storms before people were here recording them as well. So
what I hear is that this is a little bit about erosion, but it's a lot about people too. And do you know the circumstances under which Lake County will allow variances? I know a lot of people apply to variances. They want to get a little closer to the water than the standard regulation would allow. And I know you don't work for the county, mm-hmm. but you have worked, you know, around this issue for a long time.
Yes. Well, the Board of Adjustments does, you know, reviews the request for variances. That is that someone, you say, that wants to build closer or expand their house or build a non-conforming lot. So there's a board in the county that reviews those requests. And there's two parts to it, whether or not the board approves the request, but also that people sort of think, but it's okay. I understand in principle these rules are made to protect the lake and to preserve the bluffs. Somehow people think, but I should be able to get a special allowance. Or maybe I'm entitled to build closer to the lake. So people, I think we each feel like we're a special case. So there's the little piece of viewing and accepting or rejecting those variances, but there's also sort of the general mentality that feels like, well, we each ought to be able to do what we want on our property, regardless of the regulations.
Yeah, it reminds me of many recent conversations we've had about, you know, to what extent is your property truly yours and you can do whatever you want with it, whether it's have an Airbnb or build it very close to the water. One thing I have noticed is that, you know, Lake County Soil and Water is very involved in helping people manage erosion. So, I mean, it does take resources when that erosion starts and when someone's property begins to slide into the lake. So it's just, I don't know, it is a clearly a balancing act. But what I understand from you is that we really do need to get that erosion has always been here. It's the nature of our soil combined with the water level. But yet what it looks like may be different depending on the human impact. And I know that we, you know, we love our trails running along two harbors, but in a couple parts of that trail that are on the peninsula, you know, the trail has actually given way and we are making new trails. So it just is, it's part of the picture. And the water was brown, I would say, you know, a long way out after this last terrific 2 inches of precip that fell in our area.
Yep, and the Stewart River up by us is still partially open, and we can see that it's very muddy, too. So even though this precipitation, think of it running off yet up here by us, there is melting going on and runoff into the lake, into the river, and it does carry that mud. So I think the thing is that we know that our stream banks and our lakeshore are susceptible to erosion. And so we do have a set of good regulations in place that are designed to not only protect the lake, but also to protect people's property. Once the vegetation has been removed or houses or resorts built and septic systems installed, then you're on kind of a slippery slope, pun intended. It's hard to stop that erosion process once we make those choices to build too close to the lake.
Yeah, that is kind of a commitment building. Once you build, then it's built. It's kind of like we've been talking a lot about electrification and buying electric appliances and cars and things as a way of really preparing for the current and future world, and because they're so much more efficient, but also knowing that once you buy a machine, you know, that's probably it for a while. So time might be now to make the changes. Let's move on, Barb, to another issue that has some nuance to it. Last week we discussed salt, and I was all about sand, of course. Sand seems to be the most natural thing in the world to use instead of salt. And you pointed out that sand is not nothing. So let's talk a little bit about, it's the perfect time because now that I know in town, we did shovel, which meant there was sort of a layer of water on all our paths, which are now going to nicely freeze and leave us with some sheet ice on all our paths. What is the best approach to salt and sand and balancing the human desire to walk with the planet's need to not be intoxicated?
Well, this is one of those places where it's a complex question, and the context is important. And of course, the key is to keeping people safe, whether they're walking or whether they're driving. And so we want to do that, but we want to do it efficiently and effectively without causing damage. And so salt not only damages infrastructure like the sidewalks and your floors and your carpets when it's carried in, but it can damage gardens. And when it gets into the water, it can affect life. There's studies that showed decreased reproduction, reduced size, even death in some animal species. So a mix of sand and salt isn't a bad option. And sand, you're right. Sand sounds very inert and like it doesn't cause issues, but it does. It will clog the traps and storm drains. It's carried down into streams and leaves little deltas at the mouth. So it's not quite as benign as it. Some cities have programs where they actually have citizens shovel up the sand that ends up in their gutters in the spring and save it, return it, or use it again. Salt is only effective above 15 degrees. So once to put down salt, it raises the temperature, or excuse me, it lowers the temperature of freezing from 32 to 15. So it makes it, keeps that ice from forming, not being very coherent here. But it also, it doesn't melt snow. So a lot of people knew this storm was coming and they threw down salt, which is kind of pointless because it just gets shoveled off and it doesn't prevent the, you know, the snow, doesn't melt the snow. So an appropriate thing is to use the right amount of salt. You know, a cup of salt will actually be enough to de-ice about a 20-foot driveway. We often say that the grains of salt should be about 3 inches apart when they're spread on the ground, on the sidewalk or the driveway or your steps, whatever. That if you see piles of salt that have been spread, then you know that's way too much. It's a waste of money, and it can be damaging to the environment.
It sounds like there really is an answer here, and it's like you said, use it only under certain circumstances and use it sparingly. It sounds very much like many of the things we should do with a lot of our resources. And we have talked about this before, but I think it's really good for people to hear it again. And I know one, you know, shop owners have a major concern that the sidewalks in front of their, they want people to safely be able to walk in and out of their store, and it might be very helpful for them to know that their patrons do care about this issue, because it would be very easy to oversalt and over, you know, just to do too much, because you want to be sure to be safe and don't want to get caught in any way with icy sidewalks. And I don't know, I just have noticed that consumer opinion really matters. And, you know, in other issues, I've talked to Super One owners about various things that I personally appreciate, and I think it really makes a difference. So if you're listening to this interview and you have noticed an overuse of salt, maybe you'd consider mentioning it to the shop owner or whoever is doing the salting. What do you think about that, Barb? I know you've done that before.
I think it's a, you know, do it. That, I think it's a good idea, of course. I do mention it when I go into businesses or offices. You could spread the salt more appropriately. Of course, no one, whether it's a, you know, city or county office or a private business, or nobody wants to incur lawsuits. And nobody wants someone to fall on their sidewalk. But it's a matter of doing it right, and then it will be just as effective, and it will actually save money and won't run down the street. And another piece, although this does take a little time, but if people see the salt still on the sidewalk after the weather has cleared and it's dried up, it can be swept up until it's dissolved completely away into the water runoff. It's still good as salt. So if there's big piles of salt, that can be reused. And I do tell businesses when I come in, of our listeners who know me, they know there's too much salt. But I think it does make a difference. The two places that have listened and have changed, and when I go by, I feel so sassy that they're sandwiched effectively, and they're saving money, saving floors. Everybody goes into their building. And so, yeah, if people let businesses know they're paying attention, I think it's effective.
I do, too. And I think it's almost like we've lost, or we just need to regain the confidence and ability to just address things in a way that's respectful and friendly, and it doesn't need to blow up into a huge conflict or be accusatory of somebody's intentions. It's just little things. I know that we were walking the other day, and another wonderful guy in our town that is very not afraid of being engaged Terry, a car went flying by way above the speed limit and a place where there are a lot of dogs. And anyway, when the car came back along this road off the break wall, he just signaled the car and he just asked the guy to drive a little slower and mentioned that there's, you know, people around and no sidewalks here. And it was so friendly. And I have no idea if the driver changed their habits or not. But I think, you know, a million of those interactions do make a difference, not only in, you know, cleaning up the world or slowing down the driver, but in, you know, advancing our civil discourse. So, you know, I'm kind of changing the topic almost here into something a little more that, you know, something I care a lot about, as you know. But anyway, so I just think that's 100 little interactions are a wonderful thing. So thank you, Barb, for the way you do that. And I think we should all feel confident.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think that people, it's just a pause, and that most people do want to do the right thing.
Right.
But they're not quite paying full attention when they're driving too fast. They're busy and they just throw down the salt. But that, faced with that, as you say, a polite and friendly sort of an engagement that says, we know you want to do what's right. What's the, you know, the bigger picture here of taking care of people or dogs or whatever. And that, coming from that assumption that people want to do the right thing, I think makes a difference.
Absolutely. I think it makes the difference, because you can, I actually remember, believe this or not, there was a time I was driving through town too fast and someone gave me a very evil eye, and I think they might have done something worse than that at me. And I did slow down, I will admit, because I did not know I was driving so fast. But it really kind of got my gander up at the same time. And I just, it was a really educational moment for me, because it helped me to see that no matter how good the message, if it's delivered in a bad way, it's going to be really hard to hear. So, yeah, I think the way it's done is critical. And this, you know, kind of leads into the last thing I wanted to ask you about, Barb, which was, you've often brought up complexity into any given situation. And we could look at anything in the last few years as decidedly a complex situation. You can call it climate change, you can call it COVID, you can call it a vaccine, you can call it school closures, you can call it anything, and you know it's complex. And yet it seems like often it people in the news or the sound bites you hear are going to sort of try to get spur you into action by making it seem very simple and, you know, do the right thing. Do you think that it's worth simplifying a message in order to spur people to action quicker? Or do you think, you know, everyone deserves the full story and sort of a higher trust? When people know the intricacies of a situation, they'll make their own decisions and we'll live in a better world that way. What do you think about those things?
It is complex. And I think, as you said at the beginning of our discussion, they're not just silent bites. And that's right, they aren't. They are far along the continuum towards addressing some of that complexity and some of the bigger picture, the context as well. I don't know the right answer. The first response would be, no, it's not right to simplify or misconstrue or lack transparency when giving a message just to woo people over to your perspective. That, of course, that's spin. So on one end of the continuum, there would be an outright lie that would spur someone to act. On the other end of the spectrum, there might be an hour-long lecture that would involve intricacies and complexities. And I think most of us figure no one's going to listen to an hour. And most of us would say, a lie is not right. So that as many things, it depends. It's in the middle. And I know a lot of my scientist and researcher friends, when asked, well, what about this? Will always say, it depends. Because there are so many variables that arise. And we know we can't cover all of those in a 15-minute interview. And I think most of the interviews on KTWH, people offer additional resources. They say, if you want to talk to someone about this, call them up or check the website, or come to the discussion about civil discussion at the library or something. So I think the radio does a great job of offering more in-depth opportunity for complex discussion. And we, I think, as you said, people are busy, people don't have much time, it might be an issue that some folks aren't. And how much complexity? So the answer to your question is, I don't know.
Well, I think that it's, at the very least, it's really important to bring it up and to sort of name it as something that does happen. I know that when we were first talking about climate change on our sailing trips, I was really nervous because I felt like, you know, how do I even know what I say is true? We try to do our research, but who can do enough research to even have a sense of, you know, to say climate change on Lake Superior as if that's any issue that doesn't need a 10-hour backstory. And yet when we went to Houghton and we were speaking, and I knew there were Michigan Tech scientists and researchers in the audience, and so it made me very nervous, just a layperson like me pretending to talk about climate change. And then when we were finished, one of them raised her hand, and my stomach turned, and I said, you know, called on the person, and he stood up and he said, thank you so much. Yeah. We scientists are too stuck in our offices and our holes and our labs, and we don't get the word out. And he essentially was thanking me for simplifying it to the point where it was reachable, and people were talking about this in public. And so, I mean, I guess that just shows the other side of the coin, where we can't be so paralyzed by complexity. And I think there is no better example of this than climate change, because it is, you know, virtually endlessly complex. It's like we're studying everything about our planet. So what could be less complex? What could be more complex than that? And I also have talked to several sort of long-term scientists such as yourself that do feel that scientists for so long, the complexity really kept them from speaking out to trends that they really did believe were happening and felt were scientifically backed. But just the complexity of the whole thing and the sort of unknown future really in some ways did keep the word from getting out. Even though even that, it seems oversimplification, because there have been scientists talking about this for decades very openly too. So I don't know. Right. But here you are, one of our former, I know you're retired, but, you know, someone with a deep well of knowledge who has known for a long time all about climate change and has also watched the public discourse evolve over the last few decades. So I guess any comments would be welcome, Barb.
Well, I that perfectly. And most of the scientists and researchers that I know agree with that gentleman in Michigan who said, we have to have the mix of good, sound scientific research and background which to stand, but we can't be differing. And we need citizen activists and research activists who are willing to say, we don't have all the answers, and yes, it does depend on many things, but that doesn't mean we can't take action. And, you know, just to bring it down to this, we know enough to say that excessive use of salt on our sidewalks isn't a good thing. So we can change our behaviors and do that differently. In the picture, there are other behaviors we can change to hopefully reduce climate change. And we don't know all the answers, but we do know enough that we can take action.
Thank you. That's a wonderful way to end this interview I'm having with Barb Berlukinen. She is a retired employee, faculty at the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center, high school teacher, EPA researcher, and general water expert, and also radio volunteer. Barb, we didn't get all your words because a few of them cut out, but I think this has been a really valuable conversation, and I hope we continue to have it on both on and off the air. So thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Katya.
All right.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. That was Barb Lukinen.